Hello. I guess we'll get started if everybody's here. Is everybody here? I see someone missing. Okay. Before we start, I am Adam Pizzoni. I am the CTO and co-founder of Yammer. Next to me, I've got Chris Gale, VP of Engineering at Yammer. What we're going to show you is Yammer secret sauce, so hopefully you are prepared. We have a tremendous amount to talk about. We'll have some questions. We are going to give you so much information, you'll be able to go and start a competing company and beat us in less than 30 days. That's our goal. That's actually not our goal. But first, we made this awesome video, which I'm going to try to show you. That's not it. Hold, please.
So here's what you would typically experience with enterprise software development. Developers look at what you have now, come up with big, elaborate plans for new features, and then spend months building what they think you need. But by the time they're finally done, your needs have probably changed, or maybe they were planning for the wrong thing to begin with. So they come up with a new plan for what they think you need next, and the whole cycle starts over again. You see, developers are often playing a guessing game, which means you often end up with a product that doesn't meet your needs. Let's be honest, this approach doesn't make much sense. So what if we did things differently? That's the question Yammer asked. And that's why Yammer is leading a change in enterprise software development. Instead of making huge assumptions of what we think you need, we develop incrementally, intentionally, step by step, and validate innovations with data from actual user experience. By making small, rapid changes based on real data, we develop what you need and want today and tomorrow, leading to a better product, better user experience, and much happier users.
No one's happy about that? I don't know. So a lot of people notice that we develop Yammer very differently than traditional enterprise software companies. And that's true. Early in the days of Yammer, our customers would sometimes complain about it, and we had to justify what we were doing. What we want to do today is explain why we developed differently, sort of how we came to this, what the context was, and then we're going to talk very specifically about how we organize and develop sort of based on that. So the first thing I want to talk about is sort of how we got here. And I want to spend a minute on this slide because I think that a lot of what you're hearing this weekend is going to sort of back this up. A decade ago, we didn't have enterprise software for end users like we do today. We really had just software, and end users were bringing their software into work. And in fact, as Jeff Tepper said, SharePoint was brought into work by end users. And at that time, there was an alignment, if you will, between the people using the software and the people making the software, buying the software. The buyer was the user, essentially. But at some point in, let's call it the late 90s, early 2000s, enterprises realized that end-user software, I know it sounds like not that long ago or a long time, was going to be a big deal, and they had to make big purchasing decisions and the drive requirements, and thus began a decade-long rift between the buyer and the user, where the buyers were asking software companies to innovate, but in different ways than the users wanted. They were innovating in compliance and security and control and management, customizability, and so on and so forth. Meanwhile, in the consumer space, there was another really interesting thing happening. Consumer companies, which were forced to compete for individual users since they were the buyers, had to figure out better ways of building software to respond to user needs. Thus started what I think was a revolution in software development, which I'm calling sort of the hidden innovation in consumer software. Now, ironically, when we look at things like social and how fast social grew in the consumer space, there's all this really interesting statistics about how internally led social projects so dramatically fail in the enterprise. It was something like 71% of IT-led social initiatives fail within the enterprise within a year. And yet, so clearly, but we know the product of social is good, so what was wrong with the implementation? And what we would argue is that it wasn't that consumer companies have better designers, it's not that they have necessarily better product people, it's that they're literally developing in a different way that that outputs better software for users. And so we'll go into exactly what that is. But first, let's talk about sort of the weakness of software development. This is, I can actually remember being talking to a big bank, And they were asking me, do we offer Yammer on-prem? I said no, and I was trying to explain why. And he just said, listen, can't you just give me a CD with Yammer on it? And I just got so frustrated. I said, he was a VP at a bank. I said, no, and listen, in a decade from now, you're not going to have CDs. They're going to be in the cloud. So, you know, that's not my fault. Don't yell at me for it. But the point I want to make to you before I move on to the specifics is, because I'm hearing a lot about this this weekend, we're all moving to the cloud. Everything's moving to the cloud. It's going to take some time. There's just a lot of fear that I sense with people who have jobs which are very specific to things that are managing infrastructure in the cloud. And I can just sense there's this fear of, like, well, what do we do afterwards? And what I can just tell you is that there's so much more interesting work on the other side. I don't know if you saw the panel we were on. There's an unbelievable amount of interesting technical problems that are even beyond the scope of what we can see because we're so focused on infrastructure. And just to give you an example, I was literally talking to a customer two nights ago at a customer dinner, and they had gone with an on-prem social solution, and it was like a year ago. And it, you know, so the problem with social isn't technology, it's cultural, and yet they went with some on-prem solution, and for 7 months, they had issues with rollout and servers and AD sync and all these infrastructure things, at the end of which senior management said social was a failure. They'd never even gotten to social. They were still arguing about servers. Social is hard enough. So that's sort of the context for why we essentially had no choice but to build Yammer like a consumer company. Because social, unlike expense software or CRM software or most software in the enterprise, really requires voluntary adoption to be valuable. And so we could not have built the software in a way where we said, all right, you have to use it. You're an employee, you have to use it. There would have been no value in it. Okay, so let's talk about how we used to develop software or how most companies still develop software in the enterprise. The video sort of said it. We make a huge amount of assumptions. We work for a couple of years, maybe even a couple of months, and then we release and we hope we're right. And the longer we go working on a product without getting to test our ideas, the less likely it is, of course, we're right, especially in a world that changes really quickly. The analogy I give is, I'm sure you all remember the time when we used to sail with sextants, and that was actually before I was born, but that we could go long periods of time sailing without knowing where we were, say if it was cloudy. We had no way of being able to check our position or our direction. And so we would just hope we were going the right direction, the wind would carry us along, and then the skies would clear, and we'd check our position, and then we'd have to correct. And in that time, we could have blown way off course. Well, nowadays, we have GPSs, and we are in a process where we basically continuously check our position and direction. And that's at a very basic level when we think about what the innovation of what consumer software companies figured out. What they figured out is, if we're in the cloud, we can release really quickly. And if we can release really quickly, we can break big problems into the set of assumptions that we're really putting into that, and start testing those in incremental ways so that we're constantly taking our position and direction and correcting accordingly. I have a couple slides to sort of demonstrate this. I don't know if you guys remember in the 90s, there was this person said they had come up with an idea that was going to revolutionize society. We were going to rebuild cities around this idea, and it was called IT. Do you remember this? And of course, it was the Segway, which as far as I know is used by people to look ironic or funny or like this. There's very little actual. I guess it's valuable, but it was worked on for like a decade, but it was a complete miss on the product fit. So there's examples of whole products that missed this, but one of my favorite examples is this one. So imagine you're an executive at a gaming company, and you got a new car racing game coming out, and you hire an agency, an expensive agency, and you say, all right, I need banner ads to drive traffic. And they give you these two banner ads, which you'd probably be like, that's kind of weird. But let's just say they give you these two. The one on the right was made in Microsoft Paint, true story. So if you were that executive, you'd be pretty pissed off. You'd say, well, I paid you all this money, what are you doing? The reason I show this, though, there's this blog which talks a little about testing and whatnot. They tested this on real users and found that the one on the right performed better, drew more traffic than the one on the left. I don't know exactly why, but it's this whole thing about we have to be able to question our assumptions. It is unlikely that the executive from this gaming company would have come to the ad agency and said, listen, forget all your crazy designers and all the good stuff you have. Have your daughter do a drawing for us, and we're going to use that as the ad. I'm going to pay you millions of dollars for it. And yet that would have been better for driving traffic. So this same thing happens every day as we build software. We make so many assumptions on assumptions. And what I can tell you is that I'm wrong and you're wrong a lot of the time. In fact, Google and Microsoft and Intuit all have done studies on the sort of efficacy of product managers. And what they found is even good product managers tend to be right a third of the time, neutral a third, and have their ideas have negative results a third of the time. So we basically go into software development assuming we're wrong all the time. And so what do we do about that? The only other thing I want to add here is that, you know, Yammer is a product that's trying to make companies better and more open. And one of the things that this software development methodology and assuming you're wrong really pushes us on is it's got to be okay to be wrong. And in most companies, that's actually a really big problem and something that stifles innovation, in that everyone's kind of afraid to have a new idea for fear of being wrong. Well, what you'll find in this new form of software development, it's just a way of life. Like, you're just, in any discussion you start with, I could be wrong, but, you know, because we're wrong all the time. So there are essentially three aspects of the software development methodology we're going to go into, and we're going to go hopefully into some detail on how each works. What you'll notice is that I'm not going to go into like code detail, because that is significantly less important to how we get things done. So first, let's talk about what it means to be data-driven. At a basic level, the idea is this. We're always data-driven. When you're developing software, you're asking people, whoa, it's eerie. You ask your customers what they want. You know, you build what they want. You have users filling out surveys. They complain about things on blogs. They fill things out on user voice. That's a form of data. But what you'll find is that that data represents the opinions of the vocal minority. Your buyers, your power users, the people who would bother filling out a survey are a tiny, tiny minority of your users. The majority of your users we call the silent majority, because they will only communicate what they want through their intentions, and their actions. And it turns out, usually, the vocal majority is a completely disconnected group of people. That, for example, the buyer says, I want a lot of complexity because then I can justify this, but the user doesn't want complexity. Or the power user says, man, I got this down. I need all these buttons and all this stuff. But most people don't want that. They want simplicity. And so we use data to question our hypotheses and to be able to be sort of empathetic to the silent majority. So let's talk about an example in search. Yammer has search. We launched with search. We love search. We wanted to know whether we should work on search and what we should do about search. If we were a traditional software company, we would have come up with all sorts of great ideas. We're going to add facets, and we're going to add this relevancy algorithm. And all of that could be great. But at Yammer, we first asked, well, first of all, does anyone use search? And if not, why? And we found that search wasn't used as much as we thought it should, and therefore investing heavily in the depths of search may or may not have value. And we basically came up with three hypotheses about why. One was that nobody really cares or needs search. Well, that could have been true. That people care about search, but it was hard to find, could have been true. Or that people cared and could find it, but the feature wasn't good. So they would use it and then never come back. And so even without testing, we could just look at our data to answer that question. And this was, I think we slightly scrubbed, but this was essentially what we saw. And what we saw was that, yeah, users by and large did go to search, therefore they could find it, but they didn't search a lot, therefore maybe it wasn't as good. Now, why is this important? Because in other features, what you'd find is they never even found it. So investing in that feature would be useless. We could invest in helping them find the feature. And we've done that many times. We've had features where customers said, we want more in this feature. And we looked at the data and nobody used it. And we thought, well, maybe we could get people to use it. And we would work on that. It's really about sort of aligning resources to what has the highest impact, the most value. The other way we look at our data is through A/B testing. We pretty much release every new feature as a test. there's a whole bunch of important things about how we think about A/B testing. First is, it's essentially the scientific method. It's, can we take a change in the product and isolate it such that we know that the behavioral change of those users is attributable to that change we made? And so we roll out changes to a random population of people where it is the only change they see. And then we can compare their behavior to other people in various groups and know the behavioral change. We don't just look at all users together. We run it randomly across users, and then we'll ask questions about how did it affect users in large networks, or small networks, or new users, or existing users. And so we have ways of slicing the data after the fact. What's important is you can't do this with a before and after test. You can't say, before I rolled out a feature, this was the behavior, and after I rolled a feature, this was the behavior for everybody. Because we're constantly rolling out features. We don't know what the impact of, if we didn't run them as isolated tests, we would have no way of knowing what impact each feature has. And I can tell you, I've seen startups go through horrible machinations because at some point they broke something and they didn't know what, and users were dropping, and they could never go back to figure it out because so much had changed. It was a subtle change. It took a long time. It's important to know the impact of change. It tells you how much to invest in an area, maybe not at all. The other thing that we do to make sure we're intellectually honest about testing is the product person who creates a test can't just come up with random stats that they care about. They can't say, I want to roll out this feature because I believe it'll do some random thing. We have a set of core metrics that we really care about. Retention, what are the odds someone will come back? Engagement, how much are they engaging with the product? Posting rates, how much are they actually creating messages? And whatever feature is being built, they are measured against the same metrics. Because anyone could roll out a feature and just come up with metrics that support themselves. That, yeah, this is good because something over here changed. We look at these core metrics across those different cohorts to understand what the impact is. Hopefully that makes sense. Okay, so that's sort of all the non-mechanics of how we do it. Let me get into sort of the mechanics about how we take ideas and build them into features and what the sort of importance of that is. First of all, when we come up with an idea, we can think of a giant idea, we're gonna build this giant new thing, whatever it is. We back up and say, you know, is that even the right direction? How do we really boil that idea down to some simple assumptions we can test so that we can understand whether that's the right direction? So that all specs that get written essentially are metrics-based. The PM, before we build it, writes a bunch of things they think this feature will do. Now, this is a particularly complicated one. Usually, there'll only be one or two. Increase 1 or 7 day retention. This one is interesting because it specifically says we want improvements here without things getting worse over here, because we think that's possible. By writing them ahead of time, again, it's sort of intellectually honest. We can then see what happens. The other important thing, which we're going to get to, is that these are small tests. And let me explain that part real quick about why rapid development is important. Let's assume for a minute that we had 3 1-year cycles, but we decided that we wanted to be data-driven. Our argument is that that's actually not possible because the amount of time it takes to create the engineering plans to fill a year of work is itself months of work. And by the time you begin work on another cycle, you've really already completed planning of it. Therefore, when you release and start working on another cycle, there's no time to collect your data, if that makes any sense. You're forced to fill a long length of time with assumptions, is the way we look at it. If I'm going to release in a year from now, then I have no choice but to overbuild features. Because I can't, you know, when's my next iteration? If I want to do a little test, I can't. I have to really build a feature. And then when I roll it out, who knows what change affected what? It's just so many changes all at once. And again, furthermore, even if I could collect data at the time I released it, I've already planned what I'm going to build next. And so companies that do, say, 4-month cycles, it's often 8 months or a year between an idea is had and the code sort of comes out. So all of that is just sort of too slow for this. But the other thing, which I sort of alluded to on assumptions, is that during the course of time you're building, The world is changing, and you're wrong. You're wrong about lots of things. And there's no opportunity to correct. It's like that sailboat going off in the distance, getting to check long in the future. When you have short iterations, you can measure a little bit as you go and constantly course correct. It's also important, and Chris talks about this all the time, because whatever end state you think you're heading for is an illusion. It's never right in the first place. The product you think you should build is never the one you build or you should have built. And so it's important that you can sort of constantly take your direction, your position, and adjust. Therefore, that's why Yammer essentially releases every week. That's actually a misnomer, because Yammer is a whole big set of services and they release all the time. So a week isn't a magic number. We would probably do it faster if we could. We do it in ways that don't take downtime. We do it minimally, in ways that impact users in minimal ways. We're turning on and off tests all the time. We're constantly testing assumptions. Facebook, which has 1 billion users, just moved to doing major releases twice a day. Not because they were trying to get features out faster, but because they had so many tests they had to run, because there was so many assumptions that larger group of developers had to question, that they have all these systems to make sure they can roll out really safely and fastly, test their assumptions, and move on that data. Okay, now we're gonna get into the fun part. I hope you're saving up your questions. I hope you have lots of them. If you're going to be data-driven, you have to be able to release rapidly so that you can look at your data. But the other big part about it is you have to be able to respond to your data. And what we have found is the sort of traditional ways of organizing engineering, projects or teams, is not responsive enough. It doesn't allow for reprioritization fast enough. So, first of all, as I mentioned, in order to be really data-driven, we have to limit the scope of what we're doing. So, projects are 2 to 10 weeks at Yammer. That's it, 2 to 10 weeks. That means, and not all products are all the same length. So there are products starting and stopping all the time. But what it means is Yammer can completely change the project that every engineer is working on in under a quarter. In under 3 months, every engineer could be working on new priorities. And that's phenomenally powerful. It's not that they have to be working on new priorities. It means that as we learn, we can change what they're doing. Furthermore, projects are only 2 to 10 people. That means we need a lot less process to deal with communication overhead, because there's few enough people they can just work together to get it done, if that makes sense. So let's talk about how work gets assigned in the system, because it's perhaps the most interesting and unique. You want to cover this?
Yeah, let's get into it.
Can we get Chris's mic on?
Okay, so let's see. So,
maybe it's off.
Yeah. Is it off on the pack?
Maybe.
Well, here you go. I'll jump in.
Hey, no, V-Guy.
I'm on.
What?
It's on.
Hey, V-Guy. How you doing? Can you get Chris's mic?
It's going really well.
I know. He's running this way. I'll go while he's doing something. Okay. He seems to be walking this way. Yammer, in engineering and product, has an org chart. Let's pretend this is the diverse Yammer org chart for engineering. And the different groupings are based on skill sets. So we have .NET developers and client developers and Java developers and Ruby developers. And there's different teams of those developers. And that is not unlike how traditional engineering orgs organize. Though it is interesting to note that they are not organized by product area. So we don't have a messaging team, and we'll get to that. We don't have a search team, we'll get to that. And it is, I guess, theoretically possible that there could be search experts, but they're not a team, and I'll explain why. So in order to be able to reprioritize quickly, move resources around, the first thing we did was decided we needed to decouple prioritization and work assignment from the org chart completely. And the first way to do that is to eliminate the managers. There is an org chart, we have managers, people on the Java core services team do report to a manager, but the manager doesn't tell their employees what to do. If you're an employee, your boss does not tell you what to work on. It's kind of a weird fundamental thing. The way that we decide what to work on is we create a project idea. We have those specs that the product team outputs. We ask ourselves, what are the kinds of resources it would require to build that 2 to 10 week project? Well, we're going to need, 2 client-side developers. We're going to need 2 front-end developers. We're going to need 2 Ruby developers. Great. Let's pick those guys out of the org chart. Let's put them together on a cross-functional team. Let's pick one of those engineers and call them the tech lead. They're going to run the project. They are going to, we'll get to tech leads, so we'll get to that in a moment. But the idea is, and I'll get back to this in a second, actually. Let's ignore that. This is the extent of our process. Does it work now?
Not yet, no. You're still on your own. Good luck.
Good luck, all right. This is the extent of our process. This is called the big board. The way we think about this is the output of product is to put items on this board, globally prioritized. This is one board. It doesn't fit on one board anymore. Each project is listed, as you can see. And the dots are essentially the product managers and and QA. The items that are to the right are people. Those are engineers of different skill set areas. You'll notice that there's this weird physical constraint on this board, which is each person has one current name tag. They cannot physically be on 2 projects at a time. It's not physically possible. That was by design. Now, it's unfortunate this isn't a digital board. We'd like to, but that constraint is a really, really important part. It's 1 project per engineer. Engineers are dedicated to their team. In fact, what we ask them to do is, once you come out of the client team or front-end team and you join a project, you're a representative for your team, but your priority is that project. You are dedicated to it, you're a part of that team, you are not constrained by the code bases you work on. You as a team are supposed to finish that thing. You can be fully accountable because you have no other projects. You don't have to support anything you've ever built at that moment. You are just fully dedicated. I cannot stress enough how big a deal this innovation was. It's hard to reason about, but the way Chris says it, and if he had a mic, he would say it, is, maybe I'll just puppet him or something, is that, oh man, there it is. Mine's okay now. The way that we've organized engineering before, where we sort of pour work on the top, and we try to most efficiently spread it out so that every engineer's time is, it's optimizing for the wrong thing. It's optimizing for the sort of time efficiency of each engineer. What we want to do is optimize for throughput. So how many projects do we finish? Are we moving the needle? Are we moving these metrics? We don't care if there's a little inefficiency in that system. If there's a moment where an engineer may, because they're only on 1 project, not have something important to do, of course they'll find something to do. We want to make sure that they can be dedicated, that they can't, that they're not in a position where they have to tell the team they're on, I'm sorry, I can't contribute because I'm helping over here. That is, it's beyond just the context switching. It's about accountability, and it's about being dedicated to a group of people and getting something done. It's also important to note, and we might get to this in a minute, that the goal of the team is not to ship. That's too simple. Mostly engineering teams come together, they build and they ship, and they have a date, and they got to hit this date and ship on that date. The goal of these teams is to move metrics. They get these specs, they say, here's the metric we're going to move. And so that team, the engineers on the team, ask these questions about, well, if we're going to build this feature that's supposed to move this metric, what assumptions can we test even faster? So in a 10-week period, a team could release 10 times if they wanted. And it may be that after releasing 10 times, we still don't move the metric, in which case we are not going to release that feature. We might create another team to come and continue the work. Because again, the goal is not to ship. It's just not to add features and more complexity. It's to make the product better and to make people's behavior better, which, make them post more. That's fun, huh? I'll be done by the time we're done. He'll be like, thank you, and it'll be good. So what happens at the end of 10 weeks? At the end of 10 weeks, these teams basically shift around, people move. This is awesome too, because people get to work on lots of different things. We actually, there was a time when we first built our search engine We had one or two people that really knew it well. But because of this model, we have a bunch of people that know search. The other important thing about moving people around is that they don't create an identity around an area. This is another one I cannot stress enough. The priorities of your company, of your product, change over time. And if you put people into boxes where they begin to create identity around the thing they're working on, then it's really hard to have them work on something that is more important. So if you had someone who is a messaging engineer, that was their life and their blood, and they thought about messaging, and that's all that matters, and it turned out you ran a test that showed that in this cycle, messaging is not the most important thing to work on, now you've got to reorganize. You've got to tell that messaging engineer that's not important. By moving people around and setting the expectation that everybody is going to be working on what is the most important thing right now, not only do you not create identity around technologies, which may or may not be the most important, but you enforce the idea that the thing they're working on is important. Because we're not working on a million random things. We are only working on the most important things that fill up our engineering resources such that every engineer is only on one project. There's the big board, you can see the project, you're working on it, you can see that it's important because it's moving a metric, and it's a lot more satisfying as an engineer to know that you're really doing something valued. Maybe you could just shout in a minute or something. No, just kidding.
Stealing a mic.
So 2 to 10 people, 2 to 10 weeks, they reorganize. So one question that comes up, okay, you've dedicated these people, how do you deal with support? What we found early on, and the reason why we did what I'm about to explain, is that really good engineers were the most efficient in like month 2 or 3. And then after that, their sort of throughput declined steadily. It declined because in those first couple months, they had no baggage they were carrying around. They learned the system, they were able to be efficient and fast. And then over time, as they built really awesome stuff, they carried those with them. And as they got new projects, they were supporting old projects. And pretty soon, the best people on your team were the slowest because they had built the biggest things and therefore carried those with them. So we said support is another cross-functional team that exists that you rotate on. We don't put junior engineers on support. Every engineer is going to take a rotation on support. It has people from every single group that's required to do support. And it's a self-contained team that is dedicated to support. And so they can not only do things to support the product, but they can make it better. They can do projects if they need to deal with support issues. They can fix underlying issues. This is like a real cross-functional team that's dedicated to support.
Hey.
Hey, Chris. How's it going?
Good.
Woo, Chris!
So I wasn't paying attention. What did I miss?
Let's just start over. We'll
okay.
Just start,
okay. Yeah. Slide one. I got a pretty good Minesweeper score over here, though.
Your what?
My Minesweeper score is really good.
Oh, man, yeah. That's pretty awesome. No.
Okay, so let's talk about the tech lead. In order to maximize the throughput of the engineering group, we decided that a common mistake that engineering organizations make is assuming that the only work that engineers do is writing lines of code. And they centralize their decision-making about engineering into the engineering management layer. So we decided, how can we decentralize this management responsibility that typical engineering companies have for decision-making, architectural decision-making, or sort of implementation trade-offs? So as Adam showed in a previous slide, one of the engineers on a team is named the tech lead, and it's a role, it's not a rank, it's not a promotion, it's just for the duration of this project. This person essentially serves as the de facto manager for all of these engineers who are working on this project. And the tech lead is a role that we expect any engineer in Yammer to be able to have. It's definitely not the case that we have a senior class of engineers that can make these architectural decisions and then a junior class, because that would introduce the same sort of centralization bottleneck. You want to go to the next slide? Or I'll take the thing.
No, wait. I'll add one thing to tech
okay,
lead.
Okay, go for it, yeah.
The other awesome thing about tech leads is one of the most important aspects, I would say, of any job, and engineering as well, is that you're able to see beyond your narrow area. You make more informed decisions if you understand the context in which you're working. The tech lead role is incredible because as you go from individual contributor to manager, you have a new perspective on the world. But that shift is very dangerous. It's not something, you know, your company's making a huge bet on you to make you a permanent manager. At the same time, you may not even want to be a permanent manager of people. The tech lead role, because it's ephemeral, it's 2 to 10 weeks, is a way for us to help people explore what management is like. They're essentially the manager of those people, minus compensation and all that. But they're managing the project and the people and their time. They're supposed to negotiate with the product team to figure out what's the minimum product that we should be building. They're figuring out from an engineering perspective what order it should come together. It's an extreme, I argue it is the most important role within engineering, and it's not a rank. It's not something you get promoted into. I also very selfishly think that the employees that are tech managers end up being significantly better employees because they get to experience management and what a pain in the ass employees are. And that's just phenomenal for me. That's just selfish, though, and terrible.
Yeah, and that extra context that isn't actually engineering that Adam just described does make people better engineers.
Right.
Like, having that understanding of the real-world consequences of decisions that are made on a project helps to inform people about when they're overbuilding something or when they're underbuilding something.
You know, I hope the thing that's not getting lost in this as we think about what a tech lead does and what these teams do is that they are autonomous. We optimized this system so that they did not need a lot of communication overhead outside their team. They don't have to go up the rank to ask for permission. Nobody owns any code bases. They can edit anything they want. They are empowered to do to build the thing they're supposed to build, to move the metrics, and they don't need to ask for anybody's help. That is, the tech lead is essentially a manager. They don't have to ask permission to do whatever they want to do. They're empowered and trusted to do it. And one of the reasons that we can empower and trust them is because the work they're doing is transparent. All of the work to build Yammer is done in public groups in Yammer. Everyone in the company can see all of the communication and all of the work materials created around building the feature. And because people are dedicated to features, it means there's an incredible amount of transparency in terms of what every individual is contributing. And what we find is that instead of having a heavy process to enforce accountability, transparency does a better job. That the social pressures of knowing that I am visibly accountable for something is far better than saying, if I don't fill out this form, people will know I'm doing something wrong. So there's a huge part, I hope people internalize this, transparency and accountability, two big things. So summarizing this part, and we're gonna get into architecture real quick. This is our summary of the system, essentially. Cross-functional teams with no dependencies, meaning no co-ownership, they could just run 2 to 10 people, dedicated, they're not on anything else, 2 to 10 weeks so that we can reorganize and reprioritize quickly, led by an assigned tech lead, it's a role, not a rank, working in public so everyone can see, and tasked with moving the metrics, not just shipping. That's a sort of a crazy way of explaining this. Now, the other part of doing this and being able to respond quickly to the what we learn through our metrics is making sure that our product supports it. And one of the comments people have made about Yammer is, why can't I configure it more? Why isn't it more customizable? And the answer is because that would prevent us from iterating using data. It would create more variants of the product, such that even if, let's just create a hypothetical scenario, that we could give Yammer to a company and make it highly customizable, and that, let's hypothetically say, that company was able to perfectly customize it for their use case. Like, unbelievable, it was perfect. It is likely that that company will change and that our product will change. So that even if it was perfect at a moment in time, it becomes worse and worse over time. It's also important that companies don't have to deal with upgrades, that we can give them continuous measured improvements without things breaking that they do. And so we have made a conscious effort to make it not customizable, not configurable, there are not a lot of switches, and users get a similar experience. One of the questions we got asked here is, but aren't different companies different? Aren't people in different companies different? And the answer is basically, not really. The data tells us that even with a big company, small company, there are differences, but people are generally similar in how they act and behave and react to change. That's hard to believe. What I found in becoming more data-driven and dealing with customers in this way is that this idea that data can contradict our feelings is a new idea to humanity. And it's super hard to internalize. That we've had these arguments internally where the data just showed us something was true or false, and we felt it was wrong, and what do you do about that? Well, you get used to being wrong, is basically what you do about that. So beyond just making sure that you can literally move the user-facing product forward because it's unified, because you have one version, you need an architecture, a literal systems architecture, that supports this kind of flexibility. The way traditional software has been built is with monolithic architectures. And that was okay, maybe, in a world where you had years between releases, because in order to work for years, you have a lot of coordination anyway. But the point we're making here with this beautiful drawing, I don't know who drew, is that in order to move a giant stone, it requires coordination from everybody all at once. It requires structure and timing. We all have to count to three and pull at the same time. Who knows if we're all pulling at the same rate, and you know. So instead of building this way, which requires a lot of coordination, which requires dependencies, we essentially built Yammer like this, as a bunch of little rocks. Yammer is a set of services that are totally loosely coupled. Each can be deployed independently with no coordination. We are deploying services on a daily basis. We have literally just push-button deploys. There's like a page with a list of services, and you click a button and it deploys, and nothing breaks, and everything's good. We do sort of the major deploy of what we think of as the Yammer website on the front end on a more frequently than week basis, but we're deploying services all the time. Yammer is made up of dozens and dozens of services that pick apart what it is. This also lets these teams work without coordination because they don't have to ask, well, are you touching that code? Like, it's all these little services. They can edit each other's code and different services. There's no ownership. It's a veritable utopia. No. So there's a couple things I want to leave you with before questions. And hopefully there are some good questions. There were a couple things that really set us down on this path towards building this system, which is very different. One of them was this. This was a paper that one of our engineers handed me about Conway's Law. And it basically says that, that organizations which create systems are constrained to create designs which are reflections of that organization. And we thought deeply about this because it sort of clicked. It clicked when we thought about all the horrible engineering organizations we had worked at before and what the communication problems had been and how we had been at companies that had a hard time making the right decisions because of their organizational structures. And yet, most engineering organizations sort of miss this part. They think that the easiest way to make good software is to talk about the code, is to talk about the systems architecture. And it helped us realize that the highest leverage thing you can do is in the organization. Because it is totally true that the people in that organization are really constrained in their thinking based on where they are, what the process is, what constraints they're given. And the lowest leverage thing is to tell someone, do it differently. The highest leverage thing is to put them in a position where the right outcomes just happen. The other thing that we realized was we had this product that we iterated on, and we believed in iteration. We came into the product thinking that way, and we realized, wait a minute, we have to iterate on our company. There's really no difference in that the world is changing, and we're growing, and we're hiring people, and the product is changing. How can we think about iterating on our product if we're not thinking about iterating on our organization? And so we essentially threw out the old idea that you kind of set it up right, and then you hope it's right, and eventually you realize you're wrong, and you do a painful reorg. And we said, no, let's build a system that can change. Let's think about the process as something that we have to think about, that every employee is empowered to think about the process and make suggestions. And so the system that I've described to you is not something we came up with overnight. We iterated on it. You know, the first version didn't have a support group, and that didn't work. And so then we tried with the support group, and we just keep iterating the whole system. The reason why that's important for you is because we hope nobody copies us exactly. It's about the principles of what we're doing, not exactly what we're doing. I think it's a really good start. I think there's some innovations. The breaking up of the org chart from the way work is assigned is a big one. Small projects being really iterative. But I don't know that this is exactly right for you. It's more about how to rethink organization. That you're sort of organizing, in our case, around velocity and adaptability and transparency and making sure the right outcomes happen, instead of organizing around code bases or languages or product areas, which is how we traditionally think of organizing. I think that's about it. The last thing I'll mention is just to sort of reiterate that I think that what Yammer has shown is that this software development process, which was first innovated on in the consumer space, works in the enterprise. And even though at the very beginning of Yammer, big customers said, you're releasing too fast, this is too much change, we now have customers who are saying, now that Microsoft owns you, don't let them slow you down, because we have come to expect you to innovate at this rate. And so I'm hoping that we've sort of paved the way a little bit, and people realize that it just makes better software. If we can just question our assumptions, we can more often do the right thing. We can make sure our resources are on impactful things more frequently, and that's not only good for our customers, it's actually good for our employees as well, as they recognize that what they're doing is making a difference. Have anything to add to any of that?
Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about adaptability versus predictability.
Let's do it.
This is a big key point we talk about a lot. With more traditional, less iterative development practices, you can usually predict where you're going because you've agreed to it ahead of time. We're just really incremental. We know there's a step in the right direction we can take right now, and we don't even need to know what the step after that is until we get there. And then we can sort of look around, reorient ourselves, say, given what we learned in this last iteration, now we can make a better decision. You kind of touched on it in the diagram with the arrows. But I think a lot of IT people are used to having predictability from software vendors. And you have this great line I've heard you use on the phone with like analysts and customers. What's the line about you don't know what Yammer will look like in 6 months?
Oh, no, it was that, yeah, it was sort of two sides of it, which is if you tell me where I have to be in 2 years, then it may not be the right place. And furthermore, I don't know what Yammer is going to look like in 2 years, but I know it'll work because I'm measuring my way there, essentially.
Yeah, we're using engagement numbers and tests to actually drive our development. And what we often find is that, like you said earlier, we're wrong. And having hit some predictable outcome would have actually caused our customers to suffer.
Yeah, but it's painful. And I think, you know, we at a larger level, Yammer was a product built to help make companies better. But it makes it better in unpredictable ways, because when you empower your employees and you decentralize and you give everyone a voice, then the unexpected things happen, but that's okay. And that's one of the harder parts as we have developed Yammer this way and brought Yammer to companies to get them to accept that if the future really is uncertain, then the path there is going to be a little uncertain. It's more important to be intellectually honest and accept mistakes than to have predicted it correctly, because that's less likely to be possible. I think that's it, actually. Let's take some questions. We've got some mics back there, though I guess if the people in front
I stole one of them.
Run back there. You have to run back there,
sir.
There's
the one way back there.
I'm just kidding. What?
I can repeat your question, too.
Go ahead.
Two questions.
Yes. What criteria do we use to assign to tech lead? On-premise. It will never be on-premise. I'll let you take the first one, I'll take the second one. The first one was, criteria for determining tech leads?
Yeah, criteria for tech leads. The criteria really is, does the engineer work at Yammer? We expect every single engineer to be a tech lead. I'm totally serious about this. There's no engineer at Yammer that we wouldn't trust to be a tech lead. Sometimes project by project, we'll say, this person has never been a tech lead, so this is a really good opportunity, or this person had some really great insights into this area of the software that this project will involve, so they'd be a really good tech lead here. It's very case by case, but in general, every engineer at Yammer has been a tech lead.
And every engineer knows that, and the managers, who are the actual physical managers, know they have to be mentoring leaders as part of their jobs, because every engineer under their is going to be a tech lead. And in fact, I never thought of this before. Maybe I shouldn't say this out loud. When we think about how good managers are doing, one of the things I think we subconsciously think about is, like, how good are the tech leads on their team?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it's sort of like, oh, how well are they mentoring leaders? Yeah. The second question was about Yammer integration with SharePoint. SharePoint Online. Two things on that. There's still SharePoint on-prem. You can currently integrate Yammer via web parts. It's just that Yammer, the data, the, all that will not be on-prem. There will, are ways to integrate. There will be ways to integrate. But we cannot build the way I describe on-prem. We could not have built a product that garnered so much voluntary adoption had we had to do it in giant bets. I can tell you we have made thousands of mistakes that had we had to make them all at one time would have doomed the project to failure. But because we were able to be incremental and correct very quickly, we accomplished this. So we can't, the thing that our, I remember our customers saying early on is, we love the product and people like to use it, we just don't like how you build it. And we had to tell them those are not, those are the same thing. The product is how we build it. Yammer isn't even a product. It's a set of experiments running at any given time. It's more of a velocity and a direction than a set of things, you know?
Yeah, going back to your rocks diagram, those people that were all coordinating to move the one rock, like 1, 2, 3 push, that's like a big box of software. Like you need that coordinating constraint to get software in a state where it can be pressed onto a CD or you know, zipped up for people to download and run on-prem. Every one of our services is iterated on daily. We wouldn't want to have an on-prem solution. We think it would be less secure. We think it would be there would be a lot of problems with it.
Got it. The question's about external communication of product changes and features. This was an area we did really poorly on early on, and then we sort of incremented and got better over time. In the beginning, as a customer, you had no idea it was coming at any given time, and it was just the Wild West. That was years ago. And our customers were asking us for more leeway, more information, and we actually had no reason not to give them that. It was just hard to calibrate, given that we're changing things, we're doing things, how to do it. What we discovered was not all features are equal. Some features have large, impactful changes to the UI. And those are features that require a lot more explanation ahead of time, a lot more lead time to say, this is what we're thinking and doing. And then other features are super incremental. It's just a little change. And what you find is, on the one side, the big changes, you need a lot of lead time. On the other side, they're just kind of happy to see that, oh, it's getting a little better over time. So what we essentially do is, as early as we can, we try to start giving direction. Here's kind of what we're thinking of going directionally, because that's what's most important. And then we start giving more details on specific projects as we're spinning them up that are impactful, but really all projects. We have sort of a release schedule, but the schedule doesn't have fixed dates. It'll have sort of ranges of, well, we're hopefully going to start running tests around this time, and it really depends on how that goes. Furthermore, there's been a couple features where we completely missed the dates we said because the tests didn't go well, because we rolled out the feature and it wasn't positive in all cohorts. And so we kept testing it, and we used those as opportunities to talk to our customers about the process, which is, had we stuck to the date, you would have gotten a worse feature. But because of the process, we've added ambiguity, but we're hopefully making it better instead of worse, and you can trust we're doing that. So that's essentially how we do it. It was a little messy at first. What I can tell you is it was much, much worse before we started really explaining to customers that when they bought Yammer, they weren't just buying a product. They were really buying into the whole system. Once we really got better at explaining that, it was much easier. We needed to give them leeway still and involve them in the process, and we take their feedback and understand what problems they want us to solve. But they understand that there's some ambiguity in it. And again, I've been on some really hilarious calls with our customers, with Microsoft people there, and the customers are like, listen, just don't slow down, just don't. And it's amazing, because 2 years ago they were like, what's going on? You know, so things have changed, I could say.
I'd also add that sometimes the conclusions that come out of a test we've run will help to determine what the next set of tests will be. So it's hard for us to say, we're going to test this, and then we'll test this, and then we'll test this. Because if we get a surprising conclusion in any one of those previous tests, we'll say, oh, this is worth investigating more, and go further down that path.
Boy, there's a lot of hands. The guy in the suit back there.
I was curious if you showed some of your tools for product and stuff. How do you get, you mentioned iterate the market. Give me a couple of examples, but what are
iterate on organizational design, you
the
mean? Like, sort of like, how we organize the company?
There are, the way I look at it is there's sort of four areas we iterate on: organization, tools, process, and people. People's the awkward one. That means we have to make sure we have really good people, and you have to be willing to move people around us accordingly. Organization, we talked a little about. We will literally reorg as we need, and nobody gets surprised because we're not pulling them out of an engineering area. We're just trying to figure out how to have the best outcomes. Process, we talked about. Should we add this to the process? Should we really lightweight? We like less than more. Tools are really about, well, if the goal is to be have high velocity, then how do the tools speed us up or slow us down? Continuous integration, deployment tools, testing tools, monitoring. These things can speed us up or slow us down. And so that's sort of part of the calibration of how do we go faster as we hire.
One thing we talk about a lot is friction for change. Because we want to be iterative, we don't want to codify anything into tools in a way that prevents us from making changes to that process or that organization. So one of the reasons we have a big physical big board rather than it being a custom software solution is that we're able to literally in minutes change something about the way we do that. We don't have to spin up an engineering project to sort of reconfigure some custom software solution. We have a remote London engineering office, and we noticed on the big board it was hard to identify those people, so we put little red stickers on them. It was super easy. It took a couple minutes.
You know, what Chris just said, I think, as we think about engineering in a world of constant change, when you work at a big company, that's something you see all the time, I think we've all experienced, which is if you try to take a process and codify it into a tool, you've just massively increased the friction for change. And so even if it was a good idea to change it, and we all agree we can't because the tool has it in there. And so as we build what we build, we should be thinking, and we decide on process or organization, we should be thinking about, does this increase or decrease the friction for change? Let's assume it's wrong. So how are we going to be able to get...
That's a good argument against configuration in Yammer, and one of the reasons we don't do
right.
that.
Increases friction for change. Anyone on this side? This side's way more engaged than you guys are. Should be ashamed. Back there? Good question. So the question is, how do we decide what to build, basically? So it's a combination of things. Well, we joke that it's liquor and guessing, but really, it's there's a lot of talking to customers, but it's not the traditional system of, what do you want us to build? Tell us the features. Often we get feedback on the features, but we really at those moments, because remember, we're building outcomes, try to dig in to understand the problems they're trying to solve. And our customers are able to very frequently tell us through feature requests or otherwise that there are these problems that they want us to solve for them. Like, the communication's great, but I want more relevance or actionability. And they may frame that in terms of, I want this feature on topics or tagging. And it'd be easier for just to build what they ask, but instead we try to dig in to say, what are you trying to accomplish with that feature request? And then try to see, well, what would be the most impactful way for us to make that change? So it's partially, there's a large part of it, which is understanding the problems our customers are having and what we're trying to solve. The second part, I would say, is just the liquor and guessing part, which is the vision. You know, we've been thinking about social deeply for a long time, and we don't think we're anywhere near where we need to be, where it's truly ubiquitous and simple and frictionless and part of the tools we use. We're so far from that. And so we have to be careful because we don't want to get stuck into our own view of the future, because we're probably wrong too, but it helps drive the direction that we test in and the hypothesis we test in. So the third thing is data, but it's not what you think, which is we don't look at our data to tell us what to build. We look at our data to tell us what we have and to help test our hypotheses. So it may be that a customer says, we want you to build this feature because it'll improve this thing. At that point, we might look at the data and say, is that an area that's being used a lot? And if not, why? Can we get it used? Will that area move this needle? Can we test it? And so the data is really about testing hypotheses. It's not an idea generator. We don't have data scientists mining for ideas in the data, you know. It tends not to work that well because you then tend to aim for local maxima. Let's go, wow, back there. Yeah. The difference is about what comes with the Yammer and what way. What do you mean by comes with the Yammer? Versus what? Oh, so the question is like, what would Yammer with on-prem SharePoint be versus? So if you were going to use Yammer and on-prem SharePoint, you can't do everything. You can get to feeds, and a lot of companies have been successful embedding feeds and team sites, but it doesn't keep people in SharePoint. Yammer is a lot more than just some team site feeds, and so people are going to end up going to Yammer. So there is no functionality difference because they're going to end up going to the website Yammer to do other things. It's just a way of, we think feeds should be portable in the sense that you should be able to embed them in different places. Through our Open Graph platform, we allow you to create feeds on objects in your enterprise, whether that's a Dynamics opportunity or a Salesforce opportunity, and then embed feeds back in those objects for those. So there's a lot of sort of portability of messages and activity, but it's all in the cloud, and it doesn't prevent people from coming to the site because that's kind of where the rest is. Any other questions back on this side? So the question is, Microsoft saw value in us from a product perspective. Did they also see value in this stuff? So,
I love this question, by the way. It comes up almost every time we talk.
Much. He was a plant, by the way. Hold on, I got it now. Jeff Tepper, I don't know if you caught it, it happened really quickly. He sort of said this on stage, but Jared Spataro is head of marketing for SharePoint. He's been telling press this a lot. There's really three things that I think Yammer sort of brings Microsoft. And there's a lot that, of course, we are getting from Microsoft. But one is a social expertise. To your point, I think that might be not the most important thing. But there's a lot there. We have a lot of thought into this area. The second is the development stuff. And I can tell you completely honestly that's the majority of the conversations that myself and Chris Gale have. We go to Redmond, it's about that. It's about how we organize and how we develop and data, and they are rapidly moving towards a world of rapid data-driven development, which is super exciting. It's because it gives me so much more confidence as we think about integrating that we're going to be able to do the right things and measure it and get there quickly. So that's just super exciting. And then the third thing is really about how Yammer sells and deals with customers. You know, Yammer is freemium, and a lot of people think that's just a way of selling. It means I have a product, but then I have a free component. But it's actually not. Freemium is an enforcement mechanism to make sure that us, the software developers, are building the right things for our users. Because remember my other slide about paid versus the sort of buyers versus sellers. In a world where the buyer gets to make a unilateral decision, there's a disconnect between what the user wants and the buyer wants. And what freemium does is the users vote, and then the buyer gets to vote too. They both get a voice. The buyer says, look, I'm not going to buy it unless it's secure and compliant and all that. But also, I should know that my users are going to use it. And so we won't make money if we can't get users to use it because we offer a free product. And that really forces us to really focus on that. So I think that, and then finally I would say, part of that sort of third sales motion is, we primarily sell to the business solutions, not features. And so we have these customer success managers that go in and say, you're trying to roll out social, let's talk about what that means. It's not about standing up servers and releases, and that's really about how do you think about working differently in your companies, and how do you use this tool to help you? But the tool doesn't do that on its own. It's not like you had this CRM software, that CRM software, you're going to use one or the other. You don't have to use social. You don't have to change your company. But if you want to, the tool doesn't do it for you. That's a process that you go through. So, and I don't know which one was more important, but I can tell you that it's equally important. It's been, someday they'll write a case study on this acquisition. It's been really great, actually. They've been very open-minded in all those regards. Sure.
I know it's a little bit of
people, but do you see signs of your development approach that's bleeding into the rest of the
office division? Yes. Yeah, well, that's what I was talking about. The question is whether we see signs of this bleeding into the rest of the office division.
Yes. There's in Building 16, which is where SharePoint is, they've got two big boards now, two different floors. We're trying to work with them in this way. We're sort of trying to say, look, you know, we've got Yammer engineers and you got SharePoint engineers. Let's forget about that. Let's just figure out what we want to build together and put people on teams together to do it. And so we're doing it incrementally, because that's how we like to do things. Nate Fink, who's a dev manager on SharePoint, and Chris Gale are like hatching plans on how we do this. Office at large has been building sort of product analytics expertise just in the last couple months so that they can have the right usage telemetry to be able to do these things themselves. They've, in the last 3 years, put a lot of work into rapid release so that they can use the data and release quickly, and they're doing a lot more work there as well. So yeah, I would say absolutely. There's been a lot of bleed over.
Adam and I talk about this process and this methodology a lot, even in San Francisco in the startup scene. And it's amazing to me how much the people we've talked to inside the Office division at Microsoft just instantly get it. They can look at a piece of our process and say, oh yeah, absolutely, I understand why you do that. And it's been really exciting. It's been our most receptive audience for any of this.
That's a really good. How do we identify people that are going to work well in this environment?
Yeah, this is a great, great question. We have a list of, I don't exactly know how many, but something about a dozen attributes we look for in software engineering candidates. We noticed that most engineering organizations, and we had kind of fallen into this trap in a brief little window in our company's history, overemphasize this one particular set of skills that are usually like, how good a programmer is this person, or how are their computer science skills? And that's important. It's necessary for you to be a really good software engineer to have that background. But it's not sufficient. And what we looked at was we sort of, and again, it was really iterative. We looked at, okay, given past engineers who have either worked out or not worked out in this system, what's the common set of traits that they all share? And we surface this, we're very transparent about it. We go back to this list of traits as we're evaluating candidates. We evaluate the list itself. And we really try to ingrain this into all of our engineering interviewers, that you're really looking for a broad set of skills, and don't spend, you know, 4 hours of a 4-hour interview like set of sessions just focusing on technical skill, because there are all of these other areas that are important. And what we find is we have one of the best engineering organizations, I think, in San Francisco. We hear it from anybody who visits the office and gets a sense for the people there. It turns out that all these other skills help to inform the technical stuff as well. So it's been awesome that way.
So some examples are humility. You're in a world where we change what you're working on, what you build may not ship because it didn't test well, and you have to be able to be intellectually honest about the mistakes you've made and improve yourself and be able to constantly improve. So we might ask a question about past projects that did or didn't work out, and we're looking for, are they defensive? Can they admit their mistakes? Can they think abstractly? Do they have sort of systems thinking? Can they think beyond narrow, you know, focuses?
Communication skills are really important, because like so much of this is communicating within your team about trade-offs and making changes. A lot of engineering organizations assume, I've got a spec, I'm just going to build this, I don't need to talk to anybody. So communication is really important for us.
Assertiveness. You're
is
in
huge.
An organization where you don't have someone telling you what to do every second, and you have opinions. Can you be assertive about them? It is weird, because the engineers in our org don't really look like typical engineers, in that they tend to be a little more outgoing, they tend to be a bit more extroverted and social, not all of them, but because that's the environment. They're given a tremendous amount of autonomy, they're in a team, they got to work together, they're supposed to look beyond their narrow area. Like if you're a Ruby developer and you're on a project and the Ruby part's done, you're supposed to help the other guy out, or the other people out. Maybe that's some .NET stuff, maybe you learn .NET, maybe you start figuring that out. That's why not? You know, you're supposed to help out. Maybe you help QA. You know, you're not a .NET developer, Ruby developer. You're this project, you know? And so we look for people that can be fluid and flexible and assertive and can communicate really well and are good engineers. But it turns out the easiest thing to test for is that they're a good engineer. The hard parts are the intellectual humility and honesty and those kind of things.
Yeah, and it sounds like how could we possibly hire anybody if we're evaluating people on these 12 things and they've got to be good at all of them? It's actually really easy because most other engineering organizations only look at the one thing. So there's this glut of people on the market that are really effective, amazing engineers that are undervalued because they didn't know some trivia in an engineering interview that some guy wanted to show off that he knew, and he asked like a brain teaser question. So there are a lot of these really good engineers out there. Assertiveness is also really important in our engineers because, like Adam said, we iterate on the organization itself. So we want somebody who's bold enough to say, hey, this thing about this process you're making me follow is broken. I think it would work better this way or this way.
We had a really good example of this, actually, is the way that engineers are assigned to projects is centralized, just like our product prioritization. We do it, we hand it out. And there's been debate about that for a while. Should people just be able to pick whatever project they want? And it was a debate that had sort of started within engineering management. And I think it was you, Chris. Somebody posted a question to the engineering group, all engineering.
It was one of our PMs.
It was one of our product managers. And it started a debate between management and all the engineers in public about what was the right thing to do. And it was so fascinating. And there wasn't as much consensus as people thought. And so as an individual, I might think, it's unfair that I don't get to decide. And to see that his own peers didn't necessarily agree was like, oh, there's other perspectives. And so whatever we decide, which this one we haven't, we could just test something and know it'll be unhappy if we roll it back because we test everything. And whatever we decide, everyone was involved. So it's, but you need the people that'll be voice their opinions for that to work, essentially. We'll do one or two more, way back there. Yeah.
But I see this type of stuff work for us. We use a lot of projects that work with users more frequently, they tend to work better. What type of advice would you give for a company or software engineer to keep parts out?
The question is, what advice would we give for companies where software isn't your business? Well, the sort of hidden takeaway, and this is, we're mostly software people here, is that this is nothing to do with software. This, you know, the reality is if you look at if I externally look at a website for a company and look at the marketing material, I could probably guess the structure of their marketing organization. It's the case that the way we organize companies tends to be very defensive and not very offensive. It tends to be based on what we did and not what we should be doing, and therefore creates a lot of blind spots. I think that not just engineering, but all parts of an organization should be intentional about how the organizational structure and process impacts the output of that organization. It's not just about the people individually, it's also about the structure you give for them. So software development is like obvious because Conway's Law has this canonical example that if you got a big group of engineers and you say create a compiler and you break them into four teams, they'll make a four-pass compiler, that's obvious. But it's to me it's sort of also obvious that if you said, well, you know, PR is over here and these guys are over here, they're not gonna exactly produce the right results versus if you said, we have this outcome we want, and we're going to need people from these different orgs to do it. We see this in lots of different parts of different orgs, where they try to run their org just like traditional engineering, where you just pour a bunch of work in the top, and it just sort of filters out, and everyone's multitasking, and no one knows what they're doing. I think there's a lot of applications of this, where you have transparency, you dedicate people, you optimize for throughput and velocity. I think there's a lot of ways that it can be applied in other parts of the org.
Yeah, I would say be incremental and reevaluate. Like you said, you're outsourcing software development, but you're still finding good success in making things small projects. I think there's a tendency, especially when people outsource, to think, well, we'll just give them one batch of work because that'll be more efficient, so let's give them 3 months worth of work or whatever. I would say even with an outsourced engineering organization, you could be small, you could be incremental, and you'll find that it's actually more important because you have less control over sort of all of the decisions they're making. So by forcing more frequent check-ins with these outsourced engineers, you'll keep them sort of more aligned with where you want to go.
I want to point out something about incrementalism too. Incrementalism isn't taking a big project you've predefined and then doing it in small chunks. Incrementalism is realizing you don't know what the end state is. It's giving up on the end state. It's saying the only way to get to the end is just to take steps. So it's a nuanced distinction, but very important, because I think Agile and Scrum has led people to think they're incremental, but they're still sort of going towards more defined end states. They're just doing it incrementally, but it doesn't allow for enough flexibility.
I think we have time for
we
one
We don't
more.
Do Scrum, by the way. Yeah. Do you want to answer that?
Yeah, so the question is about product managers and testers. When we do work on these cross-functional teams, they are members of the cross-functional teams. So let's say a feature team that's adding some feature to search may involve front-end engineers, back-end engineers, client engineers, but there's also a PM that represents the product decisions. They're sort of the final arbiter of product decisions on that project. So, for example, they'll start out with a spec, and we use spec. It's sort of a misnomer because it's not a rigid specification. It's like Adam said, it's a statement of the objective we want to achieve, and then some ideas about it. I mean, it's somewhere in between ideas and a spec. It's mostly mock-ups and pictures of what a good outcome might look like for the users. And then the engineers will look at it and say, you know, hey, in your mockups, there's a button here that when you click it, it rearranges this. That's going to be really hard because we need a secondary index and some NoSQL store. So that'll take us an extra 3 weeks. Is it really worth it? The PM is sort of the final arbiter of, yes, I think that's core to this feature, or no, you're right. That looked cool in the mockup, so feel free to drop it. The testers are there. We don't actually use the term testers. We call them QA. They're there representing the end objective of quality software and quality user experiences. So they help to identify with the engineers, you know, hey, if we're going to start testing this stuff, you may want to build this first so that we can all have our eyes on it. And this is what a good deployment sort of schedule would look like to make sure this all gets tested. They'll work with the analytics team to make sure that all the right data is being collected for the test that we'll need to run to A-B test something we're doing. But they're very much members of those cross-functional teams. Despite the fact that their reporting structure is not up through, like me, through the engineering org, they're very involved with these cross-functional teams.
The other distinction, though, is a product manager can be on multiple projects and testers. The only people that are truly dedicated are the devs. So one product manager might have five.
Yeah, that's something that's we're willing to change. I mean, it's not set in stone, but that's what we're doing right now.
Okay, two more questions. Really good questions. Is it a good question, sir? Huh? Okay, go ahead.
So the question is, who picks the tech lead for a project? It's a decision the engineering managers make. We have what we call the big board fantasy draft. It looks like a fantasy football draft. We'll have all the projects there, and they'll sort of be filled in with names of teams. So a project might say Rails, core services, meaning we need two engineers from that first team and one from the second. And we all just sort of fit names into it and shuffle things around until it's in a state we like. And the first column is the tech lead, so we just kind of eyeball it. And I make it sound like a lot of thought doesn't go into it, but really, like I said, all of the engineers can be tech leads, so there are rare circumstances where picking the right tech lead actually matters. It's usually just who's available, and we go from there.
Yeah. Last question. There's a lot of people here. Who really wants it? All right, Walton. So the question is about given the laws of different governments and sort of data ownership, have we thought about that? Since we're in the cloud, let's agree in the cloud, but data ownership is still an issue. The short answer is yes, I've thought about that. I wouldn't say I'm friends, but I know a very senior official in an intelligence organization who's a senior technical official there. And he and I were talking about sort of this issue where he had asked me, well, can Yammer just give us a dedicated version? We'll run it behind our firewall. And I said, no, because I don't even know what Yammer is. It's a set of experiments and all this. What you're asking is for me to give you like last year's version that'll be out of date right away. And that was like 6 months ago. And I saw him a couple weeks ago, and he said, you know, I thought about it, and you're right. Like, what we're asking companies to do is to give us crappy old versions of things when really we have to figure out a way. So the short answer is I don't know how, but I want to believe, because if you're, say, the CIA, they're not going to give us their data to just play with, right? So I don't know what the answer is there, but I kind of speculate that there's some system where the software companies can do rapid releases and get telemetry on usage, but there's some anonymizing and it's hand wave. Really hard problem because something like autocomplete requires that the system can see the data so that it can, you know. Oh yeah. Okay. Yes. Got it. Yeah. Well, it's a similar problem, but I will say that Yammer is moving into Microsoft's data centers as we speak, and they have data centers around the world. And our plans are to offer data centers around the world, understanding as we move forward that data locality is probably going to be an important part of what we do there. For example, is that public? They have a data center in a country that they could only have it in that country, and that's why they did it. Is it possible we would do that? Yes. They can still release the software there and all, but data locality is something that I think we'll have to address. I feel like that was a really not a very exciting question, though. Is there a more? Okay, back there. Hand jumped right up.
Most insightful revelations about the social enterprise. I think
that's a good question, Walden. That was really good.
That's a great question. Adam had a slide up here where he talked about transparency and accountability. And I think for me, the biggest revelation is that that builds trust that allows your organization to go faster. And it's kind of interesting how it happens. So all of our decision making within the company at Yammer happens on Yammer in public. So I've worked in engineering organizations that had no trust for the rest of the organization at previous companies. And what you'll see is people say, oh, look at this decision marketing made. That's crazy. That doesn't make any sense. Those guys are all jokers. But what happens at Yammer is the fact that the decision-making process happens in a way that people can see it leads you to understand the trade-offs they made for making those decisions. And you realize that wow, actually those people really thought about this and made a sane decision given the circumstances and the context that I can now see. And by doing this, people spend fewer of their cycles worrying about what other people are doing and second-guessing other parts of the organization. Because once you sort of see it for a while, you realize, oh, wow, there's smart people everywhere here. I can just sit back, focus on what I'm doing, and be much more effective at that because that's where all their mental energy is going.
That's really good. yeah, I think...
Glad I finally got a mic.
I mean, I think that is, yeah, it's... For me, I think it was actually... it was Conway's Law, that understanding that the shape of the organization produces the output. It's not the product itself. Another way I've said this, too, is it's not just product, either. People think culture is something you can add to a company, and I think culture is just the output of the processes, conventions, and people. And so if you, for example, you can't say we're going to be a transparent culture and then everybody works in private. That's not possible. So I just think companies have to be a little more intentional, and this is what I've learned about what it means to empower their employees to do the right thing and how you create a situation, a system where they are both empowered and both because it's transparent, there's trust and accountability. I think that's sort of, we've sort of been in this world where we create companies around static ideas that they've created, they create this product, and we don't need to trust anybody because everyone knows their narrow job description. But I guess just seeing the power of what happens when you're able to have trust and let go and decentralize and have a transparent system is mind-blowing. I can't imagine going to a company that's not like this. It would be painful and annoying, I suppose, yeah. Well, thank you very much.